I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi there, I'm Greg from Kapow. Visit us at kapow.com to check out our unique collection of everyday reusable products designed to help you do more with less. C-U-P-P-O-W.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We, of course, are coming to you from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. Today, we are joined on the line by two experts in the field of fine chocolate, and we're going to discuss what fine chocolate means exactly and kind of the state of the nation of fine chocolate. I'd like to welcome both Pam Williams and Dan Pearson to the show. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Wonderful to have you on. So, of course, we could spend literally, I think, a whole show going through your kind of CVs. But to give folks a little bit of context, Pam is the founder of and Heritage Radio Network supporter of Ecole Chocolat, a wonderful chocolate company. And in addition to being a founding member of the Fine Chocolate Industry Association and a founding member of the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund, Dan runs a chocolate company that is called Marignon Chocolate. Did I say that right?
Marignon.
Marignon. I was a Spanish and French, guys. You're really giving it to me from both sides. And got his start in the chocolate business as an investment baker. We're going to hear a little bit more about that later in the show. But before we kind of tuck into our discussion, Pam, I was hoping you could give us a little bit of a primer on what we're talking about when we use the word fine chocolate.
Absolutely. There are different kinds of chocolates in the world, as we know, just like there's different kinds of wines. And those are usually delineated by flavor and texture and quality. So there is a part of the huge, enormous chocolate business that relies on what they call fine flavor cacao. So 10 years ago, when we started the Fine Chocolate Industry Association, we decided to use the word fine in a definition of who we were. So it's basically chocolatiers, chocolatier, if we want to be very French, and chocolate makers who are using good quality, fine flavor beans, as opposed to the other part of the chocolate industry, which is basically more a moderate or bulk cacao use.
And if we were kind of going to compare the two by volume, you know, per your definition of the kind of fine chocolate space, how much of a percentage of the chocolate space are we talking about?
We're talking a very, very tiny, tiny. The actual fine flavor cacao that is left in the world is 3 to 5%. You know, nobody's sure, but they think it's probably closer to 3 than 5. As the years go by, it gets less and less. So the people who are playing in that space, the chocolatiers and the chocolate makers, are probably, I don't know, Dan, what do you think, maybe 0.5% of the volume of the chocolate industry, or 1%?
Well, I think it's 5% is a number I've heard, but it's a growing segment. At the same time, the segment is growing. The supply is endangered and danger is shrinking. So it's an interesting paradox. As one grows, the other shrinks, and that's kind of the challenge we have.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that we're hoping to explore in the next kind of 40 minutes that we'll get to spend together is what are the kind of systems and infrastructure and things in place to protect fine chocolate? And Dan, I love the story of how you got into the chocolate business so much. So you started out, per my notes here, that you were an investment baker doing some business in Peru, and then you discovered a previously thought to be extinct type of chocolate. How did that happen?
Well, quite honestly, it was all accidental. I'd finished a deal, and in 2002 went to Peru to visit an executive at the world's largest gold mine. That led to us beginning to supply parts for big equipment. Then, and mines are very remote locations. Then we took over a contract to supply fruits and vegetables from the inland valleys of Peru. Well, then they said, would you like to supply tropical fruits? I said, you mean from the jungle? We were sourcing bananas in 2007. I'd never seen a cacao pod in my life. And they looked like a small American football. But we opened them. Half the beans were white, which we found out was very rare. And in that aha moment, I reached out to the USDA genetics lab and said, I've found these white beans. They said, take off some branches and send them to us, and we'll do the genetic testing. Well, they did, and he called me back and said, are you sitting down? I said, yes. He said, what you found went extinct 100 years ago in Ecuador. It was Pure Nacional. It was then the most popular chocolate in the world. But it got wiped out by diseases, and those were all brown, dark chocolate. What you found doesn't exist anywhere in the world. Well, as a fourth-generation entrepreneur, I thought, gee, maybe we should get involved in this. And so I came to the chocolate business. Pam has spent her career in it. I came there accidentally. I was sourcing bananas. And now that I've learned a lot about that, and then I found out about the Fine Chocolate Association, reached out, met Pam, got involved. And then as we looked at it more, we could see how in danger fine chocolate was. Because that's how we got involved in it. But what really is happening is, it's a small farm project because of diseases. In Africa, there are 2 or 3 million small farmers. Someone came up with a chocolate variety that is disease resistant, heavily relied on fertilizer and insecticides, and is tasteless. And so the fight we're in with the heirloom cacao preservation is to preserve the rare quality chocolate and beans, while the farmer has to make a living and he has a temptation to plant plantations of the tasteless but very productive cacao variety.
Yeah, so I mean, not dissimilar, to the conversation we're seeing more broadly across the agricultural landscape, where we're seeing, kind of a further and further reduction of biodiversity in the food supply. Now, you discover this chocolate. How did it occur to you? I don't know that it would occur to me to just call up the USDA and or that I would even know kind of where to start. I mean, did you just like hop on Google and were like finding out more about genetic testing for chocolate? Or how did that happen where you like had someone to call and knew that that was even the right agency to call?
Well, this example fulfills my own belief that there is no such thing as consequences, or there's no such thing as things happening accidentally. What happened to me is when we came back after seeing the white beans and we got back to Lima, my business partner, I Googled it and found out that white beans were very rare. And then it was the aha moment, and here were all the circumstances and consequences and accidents. I then looked in the on Google and I said, gee, I should call. And there was one in Miami and one in Beltsville, Maryland. So I called the B before I called the M. and it just so happened the secretary was at lunch and the lead scientist picked up the phone, Dr. Lyndall Meinhardt. And it was just that aha moment. I wonder what the genetics is. And so I started talking to him. And he said, gee, that's very rare. So you know, I have a different perspective than Pam, which is I didn't know anything about chocolate. And the aha moment was I wonder what the genetics are. And that led to, my gosh, we now have clients for our beans and our chocolate in 23 countries because it was rare and it tasted great. And that led me to meeting Pam, who was involved in a fine chocolate industry association. And she and I have worked shoulder to shoulder since 2009 trying to make people aware of the danger we have of losing fine chocolate.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, Pam, you were part of the, you know, a founding member of the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund, which is also in partnership or in collaboration with the USDA. And I thought that was so interesting. And I'm wondering kind of what's in it for the USDA? I mean, is it because the Americans are big chocolate consumers? I don't know that I'm aware of a lot of chocolate being grown or really any of significance within the United States. So how did that partnership kind of come about, and like why do they have a vested interest in, you know, cacao preservation?
Right, right. Well, I can't speak for the USDA, but I can tell you what my thought is on that. Lindell, who Dan has just referred to, was very excited when we started first talking about this, Dan and Lindell and I. He was the one that was very excited about the fact that the genome of cacao has been done. So they have that information. Most of the studies that the USDA and other scientists that look at the cacao industry along with other industries they look at have basically done lots and lots of research on disease and lots of research on increasing yield. But nobody had done anything on trying to match the DNA to flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So they're excited about the opportunity to take, which is what we're doing with the Heirloom Cacao Preservation, in part, is so that we can get enough data as to what different types of chocolates, cacao beans, taste like. From the perspective of human mouths, you know, we have nine tasting panel members who all volunteer to let us use their mouths. And people always say, "Well, how did you pick these 10 people or mm-hmm. 9 people?" And we say they have the oldest mouths in the industry. You know, we wanted people who'd been tasting cacao for a long period of time. And so they range from, you know, 30 years to 15 years. But altogether, they have a lot of years of tasting. Because what Linda was excited about is that they have the opportunity to do the research that matches those two together. Like, and so we do it backwards. Instead of looking at a cacao bean and saying, "I wonder what it tastes like," we ask people, farmers, to give us their beans, to submit their beans. We put those through the tasting process, and if the tasters say, "This is a great flavor, we should keep," it's not about a contest, this is better than the other one, it's that this is a great flavor that we want to save the biodiversity of. And so from there, then we do the genetic testing. And as we get more and more submissions and more tastings and more identifications going on with the USDA, the USDA will have data where they can really look at, take it even further. Like, say, for example, if everybody decides that Pure Nationale, the DNA of Pure Nationale, produces these particular flavors that we want, you know, we want to still have for our children and our children's children, then the USDA can look at, okay, this is grown. We know these genetics are grown in this area, in over here in, you know, Indonesia, and there's a small farm over in maybe Africa left from the colonial days, so on and so forth. Then they can see what difference Chouar makes in the flavor as well. So they're looking at a long-term, the long-term study and research for them is the reason why, plus the fact that nobody had done that. You know, it was kind of a hole in the middle of all this DNA testing they'd been doing and identification on cacao, but nobody had really looked at it from, well, does it taste good?
Yeah, that it's so interesting to me, and I think it's like kind of brings to mind, you know, anytime that you're outsourcing your food supply, which for most of us is all the time, and with chocolate in particular, you know, you're really putting yourselves in the hands of someone else to kind of make decisions for you. And everyone has kind of different priorities, whether it's growing something that's like easy and high volume to grow, or, you know, located in an easy place to transport or access, or with a skilled labor force. But then you know, coming into the kind of culinary aspects of something, the flavor aspects of something, I do feel like somewhere along the line that as an important factor in our producing decisions has kind of waned in the aggregate. And Dan, I have to imagine that had you, you know, sent away the Pure Nationale, that like thought to be extinct chocolate variety, and you know, found out it was extinct, but if it hadn't tasted good, I can't imagine you still would have invested in the same way.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it had been famous because it had unique flavors. It had floral and it had fruit flavor to it. And the white bean is a mutation caused by interbreeding in a very isolated location. That added a third flavor. But yes, that was exactly it. First we got the beans, and then we first got 100 pounds, and we sent it to someone with a small machine in Las Vegas. And he served all of the pastry chefs in Las Vegas. Well, the flavor started coming out, and then the chocolate tasted wonderful. And he started inviting all these pastry chefs in to taste it. I mean, I grew up on Hershey bars, and you know,
me
now
too.
I know that you only have to put 11% chocolate in Hershey bars to call it chocolate. The rest is all sugar. And so here are all these professionals around me raving about how good it tasted. Well, that really was the motivation behind me getting into the business. You can tell a story, and that'll get anyone to try something once, but if it doesn't have a great flavor, they won't follow through on it. And I think all of us, as we get into tasting great flavors, realize how unflavorful some of our food with a lack of diversity can become.
Yeah, and I think, on the other end of that, I find myself more often not wondering how something can be so expensive, but how it can be so inexpensive, especially when you're looking at chocolate and you're thinking about all the steps to get it from, you know, the tree to the bar. So you built your business, I think, after, you know, essentially doing some initial testing. The next step for you was building out kind of fermentation and drying facilities on site. Is that right?
Yes, that's what we did. This is, if you visualize this canyon, you must cross a river in to get into it. It's, the canyon's a triangle shape about 12 miles on the side. And because of that, when we got there, their biggest crop was coffee, and coffee came in at the same time as cacao. So they would throw the cacao beans on the ground. They never fermented them, and then they would sell them to Big Chocolate for moisture content. And it was only until we started testing it, and we had to run a lot of tests because white beans are very different to ferment. Well, then there wasn't a single fermenting box in the entire canyon, and there's probably about 1,000 to 1,200 farmers there. So we had to build a facility, and so we built a facility. We paid premium prices to them. What happened is that Ecuador had claimed Pure Nationale for 500 years, but Ecuador and Peru have been in a war for over 160 years. So here suddenly is something that Peru has that Ecuador has been famous for 500 years. So we then went to the Department of Ministry of Agriculture. They want us to keep it a secret, not tell anybody where it is. Of course, that adds to our marketing story. But so we have to have a facility there because none existed. My business partner, who was born and raised in California, went down there with me, lives there, runs the facility, works with the farmers. And it's very rewarding because we're paying more, we're expanding, and it's helping and improving the lives of the farmers, and that's very important to us.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I have to imagine that there's probably a really good book in there somewhere. drama and the intrigue. And well, so Pam, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, so here we have Dan in this very specific example, in this very specific place, kind of talking a little bit about the industry on the ground for people who are farming cacao. When you're looking at, you know, heirloom cacao producers, are we talking primarily then about what types of things? I mean, I know from reading the website, we're looking at, you know, smaller scale farmers, but I'm wondering, you know, how small scale, and can you grow fine chocolate at a large scale?
Yes. Yeah, you can. Nobody has because, well, no, I shouldn't say that. There are people that do it on a larger scale. But there are, everybody's been chasing yield. Mm-hmm. And disease resistance.
Sure.
You know, the farmers are because they have to make a living. And so the farms that have been still the traditional trees that they've been growing for a long, long time are usually, not all, usually smaller farms, very, in some cases, very tiny farms, you know, of an acre or 2 acres or you know, a couple of hectares. And, you know, it's because the big guys, the bigger farms, have realized that they needed to get out of that and into the more prosperous. One of the problems is, in places like in South America and Central America, is that most farmers sell their beans through a collection center. So you have all these different farmers in a region, and they bring their beans to the collection center and get paid really by the collection center, who then sells them on to the brokers. And a lot of times you'll have a farmer in who still has his traditional cacao trees, and you have a farmer who's gone to a newer hybrid. And what happens is when they come into the collection center, they're all put together. There's no, you know, there hasn't been a lot, except for in the last 10 to 15 years, there hasn't been a real look at smaller, fine flavor cacao farmers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's gone after them. The big multinationals obviously don't have the wherewithal to do that. The other chocolate manufacturers, such as Guittard in the U.S. and Valrhona and Felklin in Europe, have been looking, you know, for better quality cacao for a long time. But there are very few in the industry who have done that, and so there wasn't really, the farmer had no market other than the collection center. We hope to change that.
Yeah.
We hope to put the farmer in touch directly with the chocolate maker.
That makes a lot of sense. We are going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the biodiversity on site and how that relationship is interesting with when we're looking at these smaller producers. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report, and we'll be right back. Hang tight.
Americans throw away 58 billion disposable cups every year. A lot of those cups will still be around long after you're dead. Kind of dark, I know. But I'm Greg from Kapow, and we decided to do something about it. We created the only glass travel mug that's 100% U.S. made. You can check it out alongside our complete line of everyday reusables at kapow.com, CUPPOW.com.
Okay, we are back. We are talking chocolate today on the Farm Report. We are on the line with Pam Williams of Aquila Chocolat and Dan Pearson from Marignon Chocolat. And we were talking a little bit before the break about the size of farmers, the size of producers of fine chocolate. But one of the other things that I think is so interesting is this other, I think you can make the assumption that these smaller producers are also operating in areas of very kind of high biodiversity. That is, there's a lot of different things growing in or around the chocolate. So you're having these other kind of natural barriers to disease or pests. Is that right, Pam? Did I characterize that correctly?
It just depends on the regions. Yes, that can be a case. Like in Dan's case, the valley was basically hard to get to and out in the middle of nowhere. So there wasn't a lot of pressure on the cacao farmers, who were doing both coffee and cacao, to make any changes. For them, it was, Dan, I think I'm right with this, it was just a side product that they were doing.
Let me speak to that a moment. Yes, biodiversity is all, that's what they have. We haven't got a single farm that doesn't have more than five or six crops growing. It's kind of like my great-grandparents back in Indiana, that they had four or five different crops because they didn't want to have one crop because prices may change within them. Now, one thing I have found there is that they couldn't get fine chocolate has real issues with getting too big a plantation because all the diseases are airborne. Hmm. Now, in this canyon, they don't really have that problem. Most of the farms are no bigger than 2 or 3 acres. Planted in cacao, but then they have grapefruit, and they have coffee, and they have lemons, and they have all other kinds of crops. So they don't have a lot of disease issues. But the people, and I can speak to Peru, but the people who've tried to make bigger plantations with fine chocolate that are very disease, diseases strike them easily, is one of the issues that we have, as opposed to this new hybrid that you can plant plantations. It has no flavor, but it is disease resistant. So, yes, in the only biodiversity there. Someone's working on a documentary that came down with us in April, and they were shocked to see that there was still a place that had all this diversity. But, of course, that's rare anymore because of industrial farming.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you think about it in a very practical way, you know, you get up in the morning, you're on your farm. It's much easier to, you know, manage and harvest in some ways a very kind of expansive and like orderly operation because you can build, you know, mechanized equipment for it and things are laid out in a very kind of organized way. But I think that doesn't always translate into the thing that we're, I think, most interested in. And here at the Heritage Radio Network, and I think that you guys are, is the flavor components. I mean, how much does mechanization or use of other types of equipment come into play in the chocolate space? I mean, I'm assuming we're not, you know, making comparisons to, you know, the cornfields of your youth, Dan, and the giant, you know, 50-row combines. But when we think about, you know, cost to the consumer, cost to chocolate makers, obviously, you know, labor and scale and volume are all kind of part of what drive that cost up or down. So what are the like main ways that things become more efficient outside of just varieties that produce more? I don't know, Pam, if maybe you want to jump in there.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that cacao needs post-harvest processes. There are certain processes that have to be done before the dried beans can be shipped to the chocolate maker. In Dan's case, he does it on site. In most cases, the farmers do those processes themselves. For example, let's say you're growing bananas. So you have your banana trees in the farm. You watch the bananas grow. You may have to bag them for insects and that kind of a thing. Fertilize, possibly do pesticides. I don't know a lot about bananas, but that's pretty much it. And when they're ripe, you cut them off, take them to the distribution center where they're washed and packaged, and they're sent out. With cacao, the first problem you run up against, besides knowing when the cacao pods are ripe, is basically they're cut off the tree by hand. And that still is the best way and pretty much the only way that anybody is harvesting cacao. So that means there's no real mechanization that can happen in that part of the cycle.
No matter what size the farm is or where it's located,
no,
more or less.
No,
okay.
No.
Yes, that's true.
If you're a smart farmer, you have learned that you prune your trees to let a little more light into the fruit, plus to encourage the fruit to grow lower down on the tree, so on and so forth, to help with the harvesting process. But the harvesting process is basically by hand. Then you have to ferment the beans. For bulk beans, a lot of times they'll skip that. They'll just take them right to drying, and off they go. But to bring out the best flavors of whatever cacao you have, it doesn't matter the type, you can, by treating it well during the fermentation process, you give the bean the best chance at having its great flavors. So there is this fermentation process that has to go on, and that is a cost to the farmer, because that can take 5-7 days for that fermentation to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next step is, once you've fermented them, you take them out and you dry them. And that, again, takes a few days to get them dry, depending on where you are. If you're in a really wet climate, you have to build drying sheds to be able to dry, because you just don't have enough sun during the day to do that. And if they get wet, you end up with mold problems. So before you can actually bag up your crop and sell it to someone, you have to go through these other laborious types of processes. Can they be mechanized? The most mechanization I have seen is in a farm in Costa Rica. He had taken banana cables that they use with bananas, where they run cables down the each row of trees, and in the banana business, they have hooks on them, and they just hook the banana bunches over there, and then they pull it up through the cables at the end of the day to the road, and it's taken from there. And what he ended up doing is he cut barrels in half and attached them to the cable, ran those down, and so as the guys were harvesting, they were able to not have to carry all the pods, which are heavy,
mm-hmm.
out to the road. They could put them on that, and at the end of the day, they pulled them out. And I did see that same farm had a cracker, a mechanized cracker of the pods to open the pods, that he had cobbled together from another piece of equipment. But that's pretty much it. Dan, have you seen any other mechanisms being used in your look at other farms?
Well, the thing that happens with us is there are all these small farmers, and we, there's no one fermenting there. Most small farmers don't ferment themselves. They either sell it to a nonprofit co-op that does it, because it's a difficult thing to do on an individual farm with four or five crops. But it's in our case, everyone has the same thing. There are all these tiny farms, and you have to go out. We pick up the beans wet, and we transport them to our center. And because the steps are complicated, it's very, very hard to mechanize. We have not seen it. I mean, labor is still cheaper than mechanization, but when you bring these beans in, you're putting them in a fermenting box that holds about 300 or 400 pounds of beans. And then it's in that box for 5 to 7 days. You have to churn them every day so the temperatures are the same. And it's very difficult to mechanize that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't. It's still cheaper to use labor, and we hire from the local community. We pay premium prices. But it's not an industry that lends itself to mechanization because most farms are, you know, they're not on the freeway.
Right.
They're in remote locations. And picking them up, in our case, we don't have a single paved road in the canyon, so we are literally picking them up in trucks and motorcycles, wet, and then bringing them in. So far, I haven't seen a real advancement in mechanization because so many tiny farmers at so many remote locations, it has not lent itself to mechanization yet.
Right. So even if you're looking at a larger plantation style, the benefits, if we're thinking about volume of production, are coming from the genetics of the bean primarily, not the kind of harvesting or not on the like post harvest end. Is that right?
Well, see, the thing is, now in my experience, and I can only really talk about Peru,
Peru's
twice the size of Texas, so it's a very big place. But in Peru, there are no plantations because of the airborne diseases. The only plantations are this hybrid, which is called CCN51. They can mechanize the planting. They can mechanize the harvesting because it's the typical plantation. Lots of fertilizers. The farmers get hooked on having used a lot of fertilizers, a lot of pesticides. But that chocolate is going to industrial chocolate. Those are the Hershey bars we all grew up on.
Right.
But no, when you have small farms and you have to plant other crops to protect them because of disease, very difficult to mechanize.
So I guess, Pam, and maybe if you want to add to that point, my question was when we're talking about kind of smaller scale fine chocolate producers, you're not seeing any opportunities for that type of like a mechanization, but it is something that is done for bean growers in a more kind of commodity destination chocolate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think the processes are pretty much the same. It's all based on labor.
Yeah.
Where you can get some, if you're really high volume, where you can get some scale to be able to reduce your labor costs are in skipping the fermentation totally, which some people do for bulk commodity cacao. You can also develop your fermentation boxes to be easier to use. They use a step method where you put the beans up at the top and then leave them there to do part of their fermentation, then you open that box and everything tumbles down into the next box on the next step lower, giving it, because you want to aerate it.
Right.
And that's part of, I did have a conversation with Ed Seguin, who is been in the chocolate business forever. And I said to him, you know, couldn't we develop for fermentation some kind of machine, like they use in the wine industry with their fermentation, an accepted kind of practice where the machine would do the tumbling and do the whatever. And he said, yes, that's possible to do that. He said, but it's just way, 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 way too expensive for it to be of any value to the small farmers that make up the fine cacao end of the business.
That makes sense. And I guess the reason I belabor this point is because I want to use the last couple of minutes that we have here today to talk a little bit about, you know, cost as we're experiencing it on the consumer end. So, you know, I can go to, you know, my bodega on the corner here in New York City and buy a Hershey bar for somewhere, you know, around $1, $1.25, $1.40, depending on the mood of my bodega guy that day. But if I am in the market for a kind of fine chocolate bar, you can be looking at, you know, upwards of $14, $15. And obviously, you know, you're going to have the exterior aesthetics of these bars, you know, beautiful paper, lovely font, like the kind of signatures and prematures of, you know, a high value product that you're going to see. But really the difference in these chocolates is happening, you know, not on the exterior primarily, but on the interior. And it seems like every step of the way here, it's just the costs are like higher across the board in all these spaces. So what do we, I mean, I guess I feel like the fine chocolate world has not done a great job at explaining to consumers why things can cost so much and so little at the same time. So what should we be telling folks? Like, what are the kind of talking points for like Farm Report listeners who are out there and want to sit down and like feel empowered to enjoy their $14 bar of chocolate, and share that information in a more simple way? Cause not everybody is going to dedicate their life to chocolate as you guys have. What are the kind of easy takeaways and tools we should be giving folks to understand these differences?
Well, may I address that? If you look at the whole value chain, we, with fine chocolate, our beans, we are working very hard to ferment them, protect the flavor. But then once it comes to the manufacturer, you can go, and I've seen them, Hershey has 100-ton machines. They take the temperature way up. They burn out any kind of flavor that may have been there. They then add artificial flavors, and you have an end bar. So when you're doing 100 tons at a time...
What does that even look like, 100 tons of chocolate beans? Holy cow.
Well, but you see, they're buying from Africa. They probably haven't even fermented those beans. They're paying way below what prices normally should be paid. And then they're making these huge machines, and all the flavor you taste are artificially added. In our case, we are taking the time and effort to ferment them, and then when they come over here, the machinery probably isn't doing more than 1 or 2 tons at a time. They roast at low temperatures to be able to protect those flavors, and when you get that expensive bar, it is a natural flavor. There's nothing added in there as a preservative. Nothing is added in there as an artificial flavor. You're getting the real thing. It's like in California, which is now the $3 chuck wine.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to those places, and after watching how it's made, I'd never drink it.
Right. Well, it's kind
because
of...
Because it's these giant machines with artificial flavors added to it.
Yeah, I think when you look at a package of Kraft Singles and it says that it's not cheese, but it's cheese food.
So, right.
So kind of a Hershey's bar is not chocolate, but it's like chocolate food. It's like it's some amalgamation of ingredients with chocolate flavoring added at the end in some way.
Let me give you an example. You can call chocolate in the United States if it has 11% chocolate in it.
Wow. Okay. So
the rest is sugar and artificial flavors. Where if you're buying fine chocolate, it tells you exactly how much of that is chocolate, and usually all that is added besides that is sugar.
Pam, I am going to let you have the last word here, you know, up on your chocolate soapbox. Give us the gospel. What should we be doing out here?
I think, number one, what people have to do, what us consumers and chocolate lovers have to do, is taste your chocolate. In other words, we're in a really great, great place right now where people care about where their chocolate came from and their food in general, obviously. They care about the flavor that they're giving themselves and their family. And I think that regardless of the price, if you taste a chocolate bar that you love and you look at the website of the chocolate manufacturer and get their story and understand what they're doing, then it's all good. You know, give the industry that opportunity to tantalize your taste buds. That's really, I teach that in my classes. That's the only way you learn how to discern better or, you know, not so good flavor, is to train your taste buds to recognize something that tastes wonderful.
So, listeners, I have a challenge for you. Get out there, take that Friday night cocktail money and invest it in a handful of chocolate bars. Then maybe seal yourself, in a dark room, close your eyes, put a square in your mouth, and kind of let some magic happen.
You got it.
Taste it rather than eat it.
Yeah. Well, Pam and Dan, I hope that we will have you guys back again soon. I know there's tons more that we did not get to, but I learned so much. I really appreciate you guys taking some time to share your knowledge and experience with us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
I will have links to the websites for these guys, links to the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund, all the good stuff on the Farm Page website, which is www.heritageradionetwork.org. Just click the Farm Report, and we'll put all those pieces of information there, because we're dealing with the French and the Spanish. And I want you guys to come on and visit, and definitely lots more to learn. Thank you guys again so much. Thanks for tuning in. I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. You can find me at Erin_Fairbanks on Instagram, Twitter, or Snapchat. If you like the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. It really helps us know how to get better and helps other people find us. And of course, we are a member-supported nonprofit radio station. So if you like what you hear, visit www.heritageradionetwork.org. Click that beating heart and become a member today. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Kapow?
Yeah.
All right.
You don't have to wear them the whole time if you don't want them.
No, I'll just stick it on. It's okay. I'll just listen. Do I hear anything when I'm listening, when I'm talking?
Yourself.
Yeah, right. I think that's a good idea. And then I could say, oops.
You test that for me?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Now we're rolling whenever you're ready.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. Today I'm talking about feeding the hungry. We've seen them all on the streets begging for money. However, some people don't want to give them money because it might be spent on drugs, alcohol, other vices. So they offer them food instead. The beggars usually want money, and now they have your food, which may be different than what they had wanted to eat. Or they can eat your food that you gave them, but they'll probably throw it away. And they don't have the money they were asking for. So what do donors do? Well, donors still want a little more control where their money is being spent. But think about it. When you served a meal in a restaurant and you tipped the server, do you have any control over where they spend that tip? How do you know that it isn't going to be used to party like it's 1999? One alternative is you can donate money to a charity. But do you know what becomes of your donation? Some of the hunger charities do a good job. That means they use most of the donations, between 75 and 90%, to get food to the people who need it. But be aware, there are many charities that don't spend most of the money raised on feeding the hungry. Instead, they have big salaries and expense accounts. In New York City, some of the best charities are Action Against Hunger. They work to eliminate hunger, especially during and after emergency situations due to conflicts or natural disasters. Well, there's City Harvest. They're working on ending hunger through food rescue and redistribution. And there's Food Bank for NYC. They work to end hunger by organizing food, information, and support for community survival and dignity. Nationally, we all know there's Meals on Wheels. They do a good job of empowering local community programs to improve the health and quality of the lives of the seniors so that no one is left hungry or isolated. If you still want to give money or food to the street beggars, did you know that in some cities it's illegal? The theory is that it is sanctioning homelessness, and it takes funds and food away from soup kitchens and other charities that work to feed the hungry. Restaurateurs have been feeding the homeless for years, and now some of them are being fined for doing that. Finally, the street recipients of your donations can be beaten, harassed, and robbed because they now have food or money. So what can you do if you're so inclined to help? Well, you can give money or gift cards to hunger organizations. It's a tax deduction. You can separate or donate your recyclables, which is really great for the environment. You can donate food to the food bank, which also could be a tax deduction. You can volunteer at the hunger programs, which is a good way to give back to your community. You can recruit schools and businesses to support food drives or fundraisers. You can employ the homeless. We've all seen the signs, "We will work for food." Or finally, you can work with your local politicians and get programs passed that could work in your community. I don't know, feeding the people on the streets, maybe it's not my job. Thank you.
Cool. You want to hear any of that back, or you want to run through it one more time? Are you not wearing headphones?